We will start with a call of the roll, please.
Viviaki Raju.
She was here. Oh, Nicholas is holding her proxy.
Amita Akpan. Lucia Balastrary. Lizzie Barrett. Issa Tuberi. Franklin Berry. Simone Chan. Rocco Lorenzo.
Here.
Laura Duram. David Diao. Harris Everett.
Present.
Christian Flournoy. Allison Halkowski.
Not here.
Niles Height. Cassandra Jordan.
Here.
Sion Kim.
Present.
Clyde Letterman.
Present.
Flora Meng. Yash Moitra.
Letterman is proxy.
Suraj Parikh.
Present.
Casey Platkin.
Present.
Amani Rizeka.
Present.
Stellar Sun.
Present.
David Suarez. Benjamin Terhar. Claire Ting.
I have her proxy.
That's Representative Wong.
Adam Vincent. Amy Wang. Patrick Keel.
Present and voting. Present and non-voting, actually, technically. Okay, before we get started, any further, some administrative updates. I would move by unanimous consent to add Resolution 68, which we discussed in Executive Committee, but due to Executive Vice President Ting's filming on the Dr. Phil Show, which will come out next month. Congratulations, Executive Vice President Ting. Resolution 68 to end legacy admissions to the agenda. As well as Resolution 67, issuing recommendations regarding student employment and wages committee report, as well as Resolution 66, finalization of survey question language. Is there any dissent to that motion? Seeing none, those are added on the new business agenda. We will now read the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located in the traditional homelands of the Gagahono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gagahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gagahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gagahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Please open the March 14th meeting minutes, and if I can get a motion to approve or reject or amend, please make the motion when available.
I make a motion to approve the meeting minutes.
The previous question is ordered. Is there any dissent on the motion to approve the March 14th meeting minutes? Seeing none, the March 14th meeting minutes are approved. We will now move to the announcement section of our agenda. I will start. Evan Mandery, the author and Peabody winner of the book Poison Ivy, will be giving a talk tonight. If anybody in the audience or members of the assembly are interested, it's from 7 to 9 in Goldwin Smith Hall, G76. It will be on legacy admissions. This is part of our student assembly speaker series. It should be really interesting. A lot of opportunities for dialogue about the structural inequities of legacy admissions. So please feel free to attend. It'll be a great opportunity, I think. Also, there's a leadership breakfast last Thursday, in which we discussed the interim expressive activity policy. I think there's general consensus on the fact that we're going to try to work towards a more collaborative solution going forward. And hopefully I will have more updates for you all in the coming days and weeks. Vice President Letterman, you're next on the list.
Sure. A couple updates. First, I want to say this past weekend, we had the SUNY Student Assembly Executive Committee, which represents 327,000 SUNY students across the state, come to Cornell for a 30-member body. And I was out with the flu, and there were last-minute changes, and I really want to give a hand to Niles and Zora, who pulled it together last minute. I mean, really great event, 2 days of programming, campus tours, gift bags, the whole nine. And to Eric, who pulled together this. I mean, everyone's been playing Party Planner this week, but it was very successful, and they were very impressed, and it's the first time they've been here since 2006. And so hopefully we'll match that with all, some of us, and if you still want to go, I can add you to the SUNY Student Assembly Conference, which is in Glens Falls, New York, at the end of April. But just give a hand to both Niles and Zora. Fantastic work this week. I have a couple more. The Internal Operations Committee will be meeting tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. in Goldwin Smith Hall. We'll continue our discussion. We have some resolution coming up today, but we'll continue our discussion of transition planning for the assembly. We also have the, as I mentioned in past meetings, Dave Prouty, who's a member of the National Labor Relations Board, who's one of President Biden's appointees, is coming to Cornell on April 9th. Also known as the day after the eclipse. So we'll have that. But if you could all help with promotion of that, that would go a long way. And I think we'll have posters early next week. But he's a great guy. And I think it'll have a lot of interesting insights about the world of labor relations in the modern United States. And then later we will also have, which we add to the agenda, a resolution finalizing survey questions for ones that we had done previously, but we hadn't finalized the text and what the actual options are. So we've got to do that. But that's everything I've got.
Thank you, Vice President Letterman. Director Thomas on registering for elections.
Yeah, just really quickly, just wanted to remind everybody about the elections calendar. Friday, March 29th is the last day to register if you're running for re-election or if anyone here is interested in running. So make sure you get that done by 10 a.m. on Friday, March 29th.
Lovely. Thank you. Director Bangura, Office of Ethics.
Yep. So this is a last call for any nominations for the Office of Ethics. As a background, once again, the Office of Ethics is the external executive office of the Student Assembly tasked with increasing accountability and transparency of the Assembly to the student body. It also deals with ethical concerns against the Assembly itself. So we're taking nominations for that. There are four vacancies. In order to get this done as fast as possible, especially with elections coming up, we have that slated for April 11th. So before April 11th, any representative and any community member and any representative can send their name and just NetID to either saethics@cornell.edu or to me.
Representative Rosiger, you recognize?
To clarify, because of the nature of the Office of Ethics, voting members of the Student Assembly cannot be on the Office of Ethics. It's entirely community members.
Thank you, Director Bangura. Vice President Parikh.
Yes, and we'll talk about this more later, but I just wanted to thank everybody who's on the Student Employment and Wages Committee. We've been working really hard over the last couple of months, on putting together some recommendations for Cornell to make life better for student workers here, raising their wages, improving the job hiring process, etc. We'll talk about that more in the resolution, but yeah, I just wanted to thank all the members of the committee, both in the community and on the assembly, for their hard work on the last couple of months.
Thank you, Vice President Parikh. We will now, any other announcements this time from members of the assembly? Representative Everett.
I just wanted to make a quick announcement to all the community members here. You all seem to be very politically active individuals. Student assembly elections are open. You can put your candidacy in by Friday. So if you're interested
next
on
Friday.
Being on the assembly
next Friday.
Next Friday, March 29th. Sorry, I should have specified. So if you're interested in sitting on the assembly, making political change on campus, you have the opportunity. There's a lot of uncontested seats right now, and that's not a proper democracy. So if you're looking to put your hat in the ring, please feel free to do so. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Everett. Any other announcements this time? Seeing none, we'll move on to the open microphone section of our agenda. Community members wishing to speak at this time are recognized for 2 minutes. Is anybody wishing to speak? Beautiful. You have 2 minutes whenever you're ready. Can you just test to make sure your microphone is on?
Testing?
Yes, sounds perfect. Good. Thank you.
Okay, so to start. In 2016, Cornell's Board of Trustees issued a standard and procedure for consideration of divestment. In this, they stated that they should divest from companies whose actions constitute genocide or apartheid or systemic cruelty to children. Currently, more than 75,000 have been injured. 32,000 Palestinians have been killed, over 13,000 of those being children. Over 60% of buildings and infrastructure have been bombed and destroyed. Palestinians in Gaza are being starved, and Palestinians even in the West Bank are being murdered. Israel has bombed all 36 hospitals and more than 200 educational facilities. So it is evident that a call for ceasefire and divestment from this genocide is necessary. However, you all know this. We have been here before. We have spent months communicating this point through the proposition of student assembly resolutions. We've done demonstrations and we've made statements. So to that end, we are here to propose a referendum that allows the decision to be taken into the student body's hands. While it is the student assembly's job to represent students, this is a clear way for the student body to voice their opinions regarding the situation. This referendum would take the decision making off your plate, democratize this process, and let the student body vote. A vote yes to this means that you believe the student body should be able to voice their opinions on what Cornell's activity consists of. Furthermore, we have prepared for this referendum. We have gotten over 900 undergraduate signatures. We've met with the Office of Assemblies and procured the official referendum form from the Office of Assemblies. Now it's time that the student body has a voice. Thank you.
Take as much time as you need. You're good. If you would like to say more.
We understand that this is an issue that many student assembly members might be scared to vote upon, but as mentioned by Zadine, this is not a vote on divesting itself. You are not showing support or condemnation of any state by voting for this referendum to take place. What you're doing is you're understanding that a referendum which can be called upon for any subject of student interest is currently what's needed on campus. There have been protests after protests. Many students have expressed their voice. There's a lot of emotions on campus. And you understand that there is a fear for the student assembly itself to maybe take this decision to call upon something. So we're proposing this referendum to take the decision off of your hands. If you support democratic processes, if you want the community to be able to voice its opinion on this issue, please vote on this referendum and allow us to have a democratic process regarding this situation.
And just a very short statement, I'd like to say that at 6 p.m., we want to gather in front of Day Hall to advocate for the Board of Trustees to divest. This is just a general announcement for everyone here.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for bringing this referendum. Per our governing documents, which I know all of you have read in totality, because you're supposed to, a referendum is initiated when signatures are collected of at least 450 students. At that point, the referendum is added to the student assembly agenda, which it now has been as you have delivered 450 signatures, and that will be added at the bottom of the agenda after our resolutions for today. In order for this referendum to go forward, the student assembly needs to approve the referendum. If if over 50% of the student assembly says no, you all have the opportunity to collect 10% of the student body and signatures, at which point it goes forward immediately. If 80% of the student assembly says no, then the referendum dies, period. This will be our last item on the agenda, and it will be a roll call vote per our governing documents, and we will get into that when we reach it on our agenda. Thank you for bringing it forward, and we look forward to discussing it. Representative Rezica.
I motion to move the referendum voting to the top of the agenda.
Thank you for your motion. Would you like to move it to the top of the resolutions calendar? Actually, there's nothing in between. That's fine. Okay, that's perfect. The motion on the floor is to move to suspend the rules and move the referendum question as the next item of business. This does take a 2/3 majority to suspend the rules and reorder the agenda. We will now move into voting on that. We are now in debate on that motion. Is there any comments at this time? Vice President Parikh.
I totally think that this should be voted on and discussed today. However, we do have a couple of very important resolutions. There's also a very, like, you know, we have a hard stop at, I'm assuming, before 7 when this talk is going to happen. So I think we should go through the other resolutions that are a lot more straightforward, and then we can devote the rest of the time to this one and give it the thorough, like, hearing it deserves.
I think that out of fairness to everyone who has gathered here today for the explicit purpose of discussing this referendum, we should do it first. I think it's, like, rude to take advantage of their time and just, like, delay it.
Thank you. Thank you. Decorum, please. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I will speak. I know, as Imani has pointed out in the past, that I should not be speaking in favor of things as I am the chair, but I do think we have community members here who are here in support of this resolution or this referendum, and we should move it to the top of the agenda. However, I would also hope you would all consider staying for the discussion on legacy admissions, because I do think it will be lively. So consider that also when you make your decision on when to leave. Representative Everett, I saw your hand next.
Yeah, I was just going to advocate for doing the referendum speak first. We are student assembly members. We are voted to represent the voices of the students. The students are here. They're voting. They're voicing that they would like us to speak about it. I think it's only fair that we acknowledge their presence, as it is so few and far between that we see this many faces in front of us. So,
thank you. Vice President Letterman.
I absolutely appreciate community members coming out. We do have some business we need to get to. I think the longest thing is going to be legacy admissions, just looking at the docket here. So my proposal would be, and I can make a motion to this effect, that we do the legislative process, we do the wages, approving the wages committee report, and we do the survey question, then we do the referendum, and then we do legacy admissions last. There's a lot of just business I want to make sure that we get done before break. And so I would move that we suspend the rules and add
point
the
of order. We're in debate of a current motion.
I can move to suspend the rules at any time.
Well, there's already a motion of the suspension of the rules on the floor. So we're going to discuss that first. Thank you, though. Representative Wallen.
Don't I get the opportunity to respond because I made the motion or no?
Yeah, sure. That works.
So I just wanted to reiterate the fact that we shouldn't waste people's times who are here for a specific purpose. And if I'm sure that, you know, I would hope that the majority of this assembly would agree to allowing students' concerns and opinions being voiced through a referendum. I don't know why it would take an excessive amount of the student assembly's time, and we can get to those issues afterward.
Would you be amicable to change your motion to do referendum and then legacy, in case any community members want to say and watch that?
Well, no, I
think we could do all of that other stuff like next week. We don't gotta.
Well, we're not gonna. There's no way we're gonna be meeting next week. We're not gonna.
Well, the other stuff is not too pressing. I feel like this is probably the most pressing thing that has to happen this week, and we have all these people here. I don't think they want to watch us talk about like elections and stuff. So I think we should just have it now.
Okay, it doesn't matter. I'm calling the question. I'm calling the question. We're going to be voting on this now to rearrange the agenda to have the referendum question next and keep the rest of the stuff the same. The question has been called. All those in favor of reordering the agenda, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed? That does not pass at this time. The agenda will stay the same. The next item of business on the agenda is Resolution 64. Motion on the floor.
I motion to move the referendum question before legacy admissions on the resolution calendar.
That question is in order. We're not going to debate this. I'm calling the question immediately. All those in favor of point of information.
To clarify.
Resolution 64, Resolution 67, Resolution, the referendum, and then legacy admissions, and then finalization of survey question language. All those in favor of this motion, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed? Seeing none, the referendum will be discussed after Resolution 67. Resolution 64, the sponsors of that resolution, please take your seats at the front of the room.
For folks who are interested, this is Resolution 64. There's a red line. It's amendments to the standing rules. The version we're going to adopt is in the packet. The redlined version, it says that redlined, is a Word doc in the box, which Nicholas very helpfully put together. I've not looked at this in a little while, so I have to remember what we're looking at. But okay, yes, brilliant. This is the outcome of our conversations, both internal operations and here on the floor, on changes to the legislative process. I can run through this very quickly. It's really not very exciting stuff. Basically, we went with option two, which is to say every resolution, instead of going through committee, although it can still go through committee, will come up to the floor twice. First meeting it comes up is sort of just as a presentation. People present on it. We can talk about things, but no votes on amendments are actually taken. And then the following week, if every few things can be ironed out, it can be put on the consent agenda or it can be debated again. But the idea is just to create a more cohesive process that's actually laid out in the rules about how we deal with resolutions, to deal with some of the issue where we end up with a lot of stuff on the floor. So we see it twice. And if we are all good with it after this, we see it the first time. Then it just gets put on the consent agenda. But the idea is that things are presented without taking a vote. So we actually sort of talk about the substance of them. And then there's time for folks to talk offline. And it deals with the front lead time issue where things can be submitted later. Just that comes up. But Agnes, Nicholas, do you have anything to add? You were both very helpful with this. So any questions?
Questions on this resolution? Seeing none, I'm going to call the question on this resolution. All those in favor of passing Resolution 64, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed? That passes unanimously. Thank you. Resolution 64. Resolution 67, issuing recommendation regarding student employment and wages.
Hello, everyone. I know this is a very exciting resolution you've all been waiting for. Basically, kind of just go through the report and some of the work we've been doing over the last couple of months. Pull this up. So we've been in conversation with the Office of Financial Aid and Student Employment, gathering information about undergraduate employment at Cornell, the wages that, you know, student workers are paid, other information about where funding sources come from, et cetera. And I think we're just going to go through the report section by section and just give everybody an idea of what this looks like. So a couple like key takeaways that we've gotten. Cornell's current undergraduate minimum wage is $15 an hour, same as New York State. The Ithaca living wage as calculated by the MIT living wage calculator is $24.64 an hour. So we're clearly far short of that. So Cornell is paying around 60% of the Ithaca living wage. Other major national universities like Dartmouth, Syracuse, SUNY Binghamton, Duke, UMich, UIUC, et cetera, pay much higher than us, up to 75% of their locality's living wage. So Cornell is significantly trailing a lot of the other standards it holds itself to. And our proposal, which is to raise the undergraduate minimum wage to $18.48, which would be 75% of the Ithaca living wage, would only cost around a little over $6 million in additional cost to Cornell, which is 0.11% of Cornell's annual budget. It's a drop in the bucket for them. It would make a huge difference in the lives of students. That's really the core of what we're talking about here. Clyde, if you want to talk about it.
Sure. Other people have done different calculations. Lucia's done a lot of interesting information on our peer schools. I can talk briefly in the report about this. And if everyone opens up the report, which is in the box. Box. Okay. All right. If you look at figure 2 on page 3, it sort of gives you an interesting thing. So the basics of how this works are Cornell has 4 wage tiers. Each job is classified in a tier, and that's basically immutable, right? And it's almost a little arbitrary, but basically a research job might be a tier 3 job. Working in the mailroom might be a tier 2 job, with tier 1 being the lowest and tier 4 being the highest. And within each tier, you have a range of your low wage, which is sort of your starting wage, and your upper level wage, which is the most your manager can give you. And so your tier 1 low end, that's your state minimum wage, right? So that's going to be $15 an hour, and so that's grown. And so what we did was we got all the wage data going back to 2018, January 2018. We inflation adjusted everything up to January 2024. And what we found were a couple of interesting things. One is, your average year-over-year growth above inflation really varies between the tiers. So at tier 4 at the max, there was actually a negative 0.3% average year-over-year growth. Whereas tier 1, the lowest level, because that's the state minimum wage, we were looking at about 2.5% growth each year. And so a couple trends we saw. One is the tiers are getting smaller. So as the tier 1 goes up, because the state minimum wage, the state Cornell will raise the low end of the other tiers sort of somewhat, not exactly, but they'll try to follow it. So there's some equal steps between them. So the bottoms are going up, but the top of the tiers are sort of not really moving as much. So your tier range is getting smaller, which means for a lot of folks where you might have 75% reimbursement as part of federal work study, you're just not getting as much money. Your managers can't give you as much money as they used to. So that's one big change we saw. The other thing is a lack of uniformity. So these jobs are not sensibly coded, but it also means because the changes are not uniform, you'll see some jobs will have had a larger increase over this period than others. And so that's sort of one of the inequities we identified. But that's the basics of my find. You can see this in figure 2, and then the cumulative in figure 3. So just the last figure I'll tell you is, so your average, your total change, inflation adjusted for 2018 to 2024, the low end was 13.6%, and at the high end was 6%, right? So if someone can do basic arithmetic, I think they would tell you that 7.6% shrinkage right there. So interesting findings, and everyone else on the committee's done just a real bang-up job on this, particularly Siraj, so thank you.
Okay, if you look at section 3, we also put together some peer comparisons. You can see we took like Cornell's peer institutions, which they like determine, Cornell determines itself and reports to the U.S. Department of Education data system. And then if you look at living wage, that's determined by MIT and was recently updated. So we put together a sheet that compared the wage scales at different institutions, the minimum wage in the area, and what proportion of the living wage is fulfilled by the minimum wage provided by the university, if that makes any sense. And you can see from figure four that basically no school fulfills the living wage completely, but the minimum wage at Cornell fulfills only about 60% of the living wage. Ithaca's living wage determines, right? It's on like a swallowed rocks. MIT says the living wage here is about $24.64 per hour, but we also acknowledge that it could be higher in the Cornell area just based on like crazy rent in college town and things like that. But if you compare us to other upstate peer institutions with like relatively similar like geographic location and other descriptors, Cornell falls short by kind of a lot. So to match those similar institutions, we are hoping that Cornell will raise the student wage scale, the minimum to fulfill 75% of the MIT determined living wage, even if you're just working like a beginner tier one job, which is kind of like the basic level. Yeah, I don't know who's.
Yeah, so basically kind of just to talk about some of these specific policy recommendations we're putting forward, and hopefully the administration will heed our recommendations. We're proposing a 23.2% across the board increase to all the wage scales. That would bring the minimum of tier one to $18.48 per hour, which is 75% of the MIT calculated Ithaca living wage. So that would put Cornell at like really ahead of the pack when it comes to the other, like peer schools that Cornell compares itself to, other institutions in upstate New York, et cetera. And that when you're applying that 23.2% increase to the expenditures that Cornell faces, Cornell currently spends 26 ish million dollars a year on student employment. If you look at the direct cost of the university after taking out federal grants, private grants, work study, etc., Cornell only really pays about 21 million. Even if you go with a higher number of 26 million, the increase that we are proposing would be an extra 6 million in spending by Cornell. Again, this is like 0.1% of Cornell's annual operating budget, a tiny drop in the bucket for the university to afford. So yeah, that's the first proposal, is an across the board wage increase. The second proposal is a constant cost of living adjustment to make sure that the wages don't fall behind after this. So New York State's minimum wage is going to be adjusted with the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, every year starting in 2027. So our proposal is that whatever percentage New York State's minimum wage increases by per the CPI, Cornell's base wage will increase by the same percentage. That way, we don't end up falling behind inflation and get stuck in the same place that we are in a couple of years. So those are like the core economic proposals that we have. There are a couple of other recommendations and like issues of concern that we came across when we were looking at student employment. One of the big ones is like clarity and equity in job postings. I know this has been a common experience for a lot of people, but when you're looking for a job and on Workday, you apply to like a bunch of different ones, and a lot of times your resume or your application isn't even considered because professors have already pre-selected candidates for that job. So our goal here is to have some sort of disclaimer or some sort of signifier on Workday so you can see if a job is truly competitive and if everybody has a chance of getting into it, or if it's one that a professor or an employer has already selected a candidate for and the Workday application is sort of just a legal formality that Cornell has to go through. In addition to that, in just trying to improve clarity and equity for job postings, we're also proposing that Cornell creates some sort of centralized job like listing station. They have this on Workday, but just one that's more comprehensive and that also is like effectively compliant with all the different legal requirements, while also giving students clarity about which jobs they should spend their time writing a cover letter for, having their resume tailored towards, etc.
Yeah, similar to that issue with finding entry-level jobs, we're proposing creating a student employment job fair that would operate similar to Clubfest, where students can go to some place like Barton Hall and talk to the actual supervisors that would be hiring them and find those entry-level jobs more easily. And then our final non-economic proposal is voluntary recognition and union neutrality by the university. As the home of the ILR school with the supposedly the greatest labor experts in the world, we have a duty to stay neutral in any union organizing that may occur on campus.
Yeah, and those are the main recommendations we have. And we're going to be continuing discussions with administration over the next couple of weeks just to go and see the best way to implement those.
One other thing I wanted to add was, folks might ask, what's the impact of this, right? How many people does it actually affect? The data we got from the Financial Aid and Student Employment Office, which is tremendously forthcoming, said that actually last year we had 16,100 students. Last year we had about 15,950. about 10,000 of them, there were 10,000 unique student employees last year. So it's actually more than 60%. It's about 2/3 of the entire undergraduate student population is at some point employed by the university. And I believe they worked an average of 176 hours per student. That was the institutional average. So it really does touch a lot of people. And I have to say, when I found that it only cost the university about $21 million for more than was $1.6 million. How many total hours were worked? 1.1 million? 1.6 million hours for only $21 million. Seems like they're getting away with real steal here. So we just want to do things that'll make working at Cornell as a student employee a little more equitable, a little more sensible, and sort of deals with some of the economic realities of 2024.
Thank you so much. Questions or comments on the floor? Representative Everett.
Thank you guys for all of your hard work. I'm sure that this was a lot of stuff to go through and a lot of typing. All of this looks very legit to me. I think members of the community would agree that they would appreciate a little more compensation for their hard work, especially given how much this university already works us all to death. I would move to end debate and have this resolution passed by unanimous consent.
That motion is in order. Is there a second? There's a second. All those in favor of ending debate, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed. That passes. We will now vote on transmitting the committee's report to President Pollock as well as other administrators. All those in favor, please raise your placards at this time. All those opposed. Seeing none, that passes unanimously. Congratulations. That will be sent to the president. All right, referenda, folks. Please take your places at the front of the room. All right, we've already heard your pitch. Would you like to say anything else before we go into discussion on this topic? Okay, lovely. I will clarify for members of the assembly as well as members of the community, the process of a referenda has not been put forth in at least the last 15 years. I think it's great that we're doing this. I think it's cool that you guys are here. I think it's amazing to see how many signatures you guys have acquired in such a short amount of time.
Isn't the box the referendum?
The referendum is in the box. Thank you, Representative Wong. That being said, I'll just reiterate the rules. If this fails by 80% or more, the referendum is disbanded and cannot be brought forth again. If it fails by 50%, but not 80%, you all can collect 10% of the student body in signatures. Point of order.
I don't think that's what the charter said in terms of, I don't think it's 80% vote we need today. I think we need a simple majority.
I'm explaining right now.
You said 80%. If it doesn't pass by 80%.
I'm saying in the opposite order of what you're saying.
Yeah.
If it fails by 50% or more, then you can collect 10% of signatures. And if it passes, it immediately goes to the student body in this long process that we will work with the organizers of the referendum to figure out exactly how the process works, because it doesn't really mesh with our calendar in terms of the way it's set up this year. But that's totally fine. We'll figure it out and figure out how to make it work and do the best we can. So thank you. Questions or comments on the floor? Representative Everett.
I'm sure you guys are tired of hearing my voice, but I think that a referendum is the perfect opportunity for the assembly to give the voice back to the student body. I think we can all agree. Campus has been tense. These topics are divisive, but that is why it is our responsibility to allow students who are working through the proper channels to exercise their voices and opinions. Allowing this referendum to go through does not mean that you agree with the questions. You can vote yes to have this referendum go through and then go on the referendum and vote no and say that you don't agree. But I think that it's only fair that students, like, finally and for all, get to express their opinions so there can be some closure from communities that have come here over and over again, saying they want their voices to be heard. And just for the community members that may not really understand the process, if this passes today, there's going to be a message sent out for 3 pro statements and 3 con statements by the vice president of this assembly. Once those statements are collected, the referendum will be sent out to the entire undergraduate student body at large. There will be 36 hours for the referendum to be open and for students to vote on it. After that 36 hours, the referendum closes. The referendum will contain the referendum questions and the 3 pro and 3 con statements. If the referendum passes by a simple majority from the undergraduate student body, our good president, Patrick Huell, will then take the majority vote, the referendum with the majority vote, the 3 con and the 3 pro statements, and place it on President Pollack's desk. From there, she will have 30 days to respond to the questions, whether she will implement the questions in question or if she will reject them. But either way, she has 30 days to give a statement on her reasoning, either way that she responds to the process.
Thank you, Representative Everett. Representative Wong.
Yeah, I would like to echo everything Representative Everett has just said. I know people have been working on getting this referendum in place for a very long time, and it just goes to show the dedication of the people who put it together. There's a reason why in 15 years we haven't had something like this, is because that students have never been so impassioned in a very long time. So I'd like to just say that there was over 1,000 people who have 1,000 undergraduate students who have signed saying that we should be having this question. I like to echo that voting yes is not saying you agree yes or no to the questions at hand, but you're going to let the community speak. And we always talk about, oh, community engagement, no one's following Instagram or whatever. I feel like this is a perfect time to engage the community and listen to our constituents. And I hope everyone votes yes. Thank you.
Vice President Barry.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Representative Wall and Representative Everett just said. I just want to reiterate that, like, a lot of the conversations that we had, like, in the past with, like, resolutions was that, you know, it's not the responsibility of the student assembly to, like, make, like, large stances on, like, you know, world issues, but it is our responsibility to, like, you know, listen to students and have, like, pose them with a question and, like, have them answer that question. Like, you know, like Representative Wallen said, 1,000 people have signed this petition, and, like, now, like, the student body will have the opportunity to kind of, like, agree whether or not they want to, like, see this, like, pass through. So, yeah, I think it's our responsibility to, like, at least give them the opportunity to tell us what they think. And yeah.
Representative, decorum, please. Decorum, please. Thank you. Representative Rezica.
Yeah, I just want to echo what all the previous representatives have already said. And I just want to reemphasize that, like, as representatives of the student body, we do have an obligation to help students voice their opinions. And I feel like this is a very clear and direct way for students to engage politically on campus and also voice their opinions, their concerns. I know that resolutions similar to this have tried to pass through the assembly, and time and time again, they've just been denied, but due to the personal opinions, I guess, of people on the student assembly. But this is a much more representative of the student population's opinions at large.
Thank you, Vice President Letterman.
So a couple things. One, I totally agree. This is the right process. I believe in a petition process. I'm glad everyone has the same passion for shared governance on our governing documents that I do and wake up with every day. My concern is, and I'm not, just because we've never done this before and haven't done this while I've been here. Well, a couple things. One, it's mainly just with the wording of the question. So if you've seen the doc, we have another resolution, which also clarifies the wording of the other resolution question, referendum questions or survey questions, technically, that we have. But one thing is, for the first one, for instance, should Cornell University call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza? The university, even if we approve this 99% to one, right, every student votes in favor, the university is not going to do that, at least my sense is, because of their tax-exempt status, and that perhaps we should have something that would make more sense, like polling students, do you believe there should be a permanent ceasefire in Gaza? You know, and it's sort of not, it may not sound like a huge difference, but
point of order.
I think, well, I'm
well, the way that the referendum works, no, the okay, well, the questions can't be changed. Is
well, I'm gonna get to that. So, that's my one concern, right? The president is just gonna say, well, the Cornell University is a tax exempt organization. Sorry. Please go home, right? I mean, we've had this happen before. With the second question, one thing we try to do, well, there are a couple issues. One is, can everyone just read question number two? I hope everyone does that, right? But it says, Cornell has investments in companies supporting the ongoing war in Gaza, which has been deemed a, quote, plausible genocide by the International Court of Justice in South Africa v. Israel. Should Cornell University file their 2016 guidelines for a divestment and divest from the following weapon manufacturers? And it lists 10 American weapons manufacturers, I think one German one. The issue that I have there is, one, we don't know if Cornell's actually divested from those company investment in those companies or not. When they did this last time in 2014 or 2016 with the sort of environmental issues, it took them months to figure it out. So we don't know. And I think I'm concerned the question implies the university's actually invested there. Number two, and following the guidelines, is it also says, right, oh, only these companies are the ones. If we divest from these companies, we're out of the guidelines. My suggestion would be to any sponsors, would it would just say, should Cornell University divest from weapons manufacturers? I mean, that's sort of simple. It's to the point. The other thing is the International Court of Justice. I think that's a great thing for a pro-con statement, but probably doesn't belong in the question. Because it's sort of the question needs to be a yet a one sentence yes, no, right? And so if you look at the other ones, we have things like, do you approve or disapprove of the 18 credit limit? You know, it's sort of there's like a yes, no statement. Whereas this has a number of things which sort of someone reading it might not understand the background to. So there is a motion I can make that I won't make now, but I do want to convey that as a concern that we need something that the university can act on and that is actionable. And it's not in that form right now, but we can make those tweaks.
Yeah, you can respond.
Yeah, regarding the first comment, I think saying that we shouldn't have this referendum because it would be better to have a poll for students to say whether we think there should be a ceasefire or not is basically synonymous with saying whether Cornell should call for a ceasefire. We're having a referendum where we're going to ask students to vote on whether they think Cornell University as an institution, because of, you know, many things that have been talked about, should be calling for a ceasefire. That's basically the same thing as asking whether those individual students want a ceasefire to happen. I don't think that's such a big difference that we should have a different referendum. I don't think you're changing the argument that is being made. In both situations, the referendum being put in front of President Pollock's desk is going to say this amount of students think that there should be a ceasefire because they're basically the same thing. Additionally, I don't think that the wording of the referendum makes it that complicated. It is still a yes or no question regarding whether Cornell should divest or not. Additionally, the reference to the guidelines is because we're trying to reference our own internal protocols. And if we're trying to put this referendum on Pollock's desk, we want her and the Board of Trustees to be able to reference their own guidelines to be able to take decisions based on what they've in the past told themselves to do.
Thank you. And I'd just like to clarify for everybody, we cannot discuss, it's not germane to discuss whether or not we should be talking about questions of a different referendum. You can talk about how you don't think that these are neutral, or you can talk about how you think they're neutral or blah, blah, blah. But we're discussing whether you should vote yes or you should vote no on this referendum. Does that make sense? Okay. Vice President Parikh.
Yeah. I mean, kind of just to echo some of those concerns, I think that the better way to do this is like have this go out as a vote to the students, right? But put it on the next resolution we have coming up, I forgot what it's called, but the one with all the ballot survey questions, right? Because the issue with this, first of all, the charter says that the questions need to be neutrally worded. And like, I think if we had the ability to edit these questions, then we can make them neutral. But the problem is, especially the second question as it stands, it has like an implication within it. So even like, regardless of like the implication itself, the fact that it leads the students to vote in one direction or the other would make it like non-compliant with the charter because it's not neutrally worded. As far as the first one goes, I understand what you guys are saying about like Cornell University is an institution calling for a ceasefire. But again, at the end of the day, because of like the tax exempt status, because they are not able to take political positions, Cornell, as like a nonprofit institution, would put that status at risk if they were to call for a ceasefire. So I don't think that is like a productive question to be sending to the administration, right? Martha Pollack and the administration knows about the guidelines for divestment. They know about all these other things. And I think a question that is structured to specifically see how students feel about this issue is a lot more productive than one that would just ask Cornell to do something that would put its entire like legal status in jeopardy. And that's why like no other college or university has called for ceasefires, because this is not something that they can do as like part of their tax status.
Represent any other members wishing to speak at this time?
Can I get a chance to respond?
What? Yes.
Yeah, I disagree. I don't think the question is implying anything. It is just stating facts. It is stating a fact that Cornell has investments in companies which have been, you know, collaborating with Israel's actions in Gaza. It is stating the fact that the International Court of Justice found plausible genocide occurring in Gaza by the state of Israel's actions and omissions. And it's stating that the 2016 guidelines by the university's board of trustees say that we should divest from companies that engage in genocide, systematic cruelty towards children, or apartheid. We're stating all of these things, and we're asking students whether they think we should follow these guidelines or not. We're not implying anything. We're stating facts that are very publicly, I am aware, most students probably are aware of it, but if there's any students that aren't aware of it, the reason we're telling them the reason why this question is being posed in the first place. Additionally, I think it's disingenuous to say that no other universities have called for similar things. There's been actions in universities all around the world. There's many universities that have actually called for divestment. I can look up a couple of them, but you can also look it up yourself. Universities which have called for a ceasefire include Case Western, University of Houston, McGill, U Toronto, UC Davis. And I think if we don't have a precedent for calling for a ceasefire or calling for divestment, Cornell University, as a leading institution in this country and the world, should take that first step to establish that precedent and call for a permanent ceasefire.
Decorum, please. Decorum. Thank you. 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 Any members wishing to speak this time who have not yet spoken? Seeing none, Representative Wong.
Okay, Ole.
Please, decorum, please. Decorum, please. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Decorum, please. Decorum, please. Decorum, please. Thank you. Representative Wong, you're recognized.
I feel like we're talking about like pedantic stuff in terms of the wording of the resolution, but there are 1,000 students who have signed this petition. And then there's all of these students who are here today who are leaving because they're just so upset with how student assembly is being ran. So I think that it makes the most sense for us to simply put through what 1,000 students have said they want to be put through. And I feel like if we stand in the way of this, the same thing that's like, oh, people, old people in Congress don't listen to the people. I'm about to do the same thing if I don't put this through. 1,000 students have said that they want to have this referendum be put out. So I feel like there isn't really too much conversation to be had. You may not agree with what the question says, but you should agree that we should have a democracy.
Thank you. Representative Everett.
I would like to say, like, yeah, good number of universities have called for a ceasefire, San Diego State being one of them. They just passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire. So I guess it's not the same as the university, but there are institutions where their respective student assemblies have passed resolutions for divestment, have passed resolutions for ceasefires. But that's not what we're trying to do today. What we're doing is giving a voice to the student body. And if we're worried about, oh, well, the university won't be able to do anything, they're going to be in risk of violating their nonprofit status. What the student body is trying to do is send the message to the university that this is how they feel about issues that are going on. These are other universities that have been able to acknowledge these issues that are going on. And if students disagree, that viewpoint is also being expressed. But I feel like if we shut this down, we are just unilaterally saying that we can't give students their voice when they have repeatedly and continuously come here and attempted to work through the proper channels that we have provided them. And if we're not willing to allow them the very channels that are laid out in our own charter, what's the point of us sitting here?
Thank you. Representative Meng.
I think we definitely should pass this referendum because, first of all, like, we all know that over the past month or almost 2 months. We have, even though we have been trying to set up the ESG committee, but it's still like a really slow process. And apparently the emotion of our student body here is pretty strong, and we still cannot really, in some ways, efficiently convey their message to Martha, to Pollock. And also, since like, even though we say that it could be better, this referendum could be better with a neutral tone, but the thing is, like, if we are always pursuing for perfectionism and it's always slowing us down, I feel like we would rather just do this trial first. And if this referendum doesn't work, we may just try to do another referendum in the future with something like a better tone. So I think so far we shouldn't really debating too much on this, like, to stop this referendum.
Thank you, Representative Meng. Representative Barry.
I mean, as long as they don't want to respond to that comment. No.
Do you want to respond?
All right. I would usually say that I'm not one for poking the bear, but as it's already been stated, the university does know, and the protests have been happening for so long. They've had ample opportunity to proactively do their own research and look to disinvest from these weapons manufacturers, and they haven't. And this is just something to force their hand. And of course, they're most likely going to reject it. Not something we'd like, but it's okay because we force their hand and we force them to make a response, which then goes into a lot of the public issues that are already going underway, which would be encouraging them to proactively, regardless of what we're voting for, do something for the student body. So I understand the concerns of wanting to maybe do it in the perfect way, but perfectionism slows us down. And, I don't think it's absolutely necessary, regardless if we know it's going to get through or not in the end.
May I respond? Yeah, I would just like to address the point of whether Cornell's Board of Trustees for President knows about these guidelines. Yeah, they most likely know about them. However, up to date, we have not heard about the Board of Trustees, Martha Pollock herself, or any Cornell committee, institution, group looking into whether the investments we have into these corporations, the partnerships we have with these corporations, whether they violate our own guidelines. We don't know what is going within Cornell's internal mechanisms to determine whether these ties should be cut or not. What we're doing with this referendum is getting the numbers to tell Cornell, this is the amount of people, the amount of students that think that the decisions that you are doing by not cutting ties with these institutions are wrong. We are giving you numbers to let you know about how serious we are about this. And we want you to figure out a way to cut ties with these companies to call for a ceasefire. Regarding the risk of losing a nonprofit status or a similar legal repercussion, we welcome President Pollock addressing those concerns after this referendum is put on her desk and engaging in dialogue to find out the best way to call for these things, to cut ties with these companies without damaging the institution. Without having a referendum first, we can't reach these points. None of us here are experts or have the qualifications to be able to say that we certainly will lose nonprofit status by calling for these things. However, what I can say with pretty much certainty is having this referendum itself will not cause us to lose this status. We won't end up in court because we call for this referendum. This referendum is about voicing public opinion, and we should voice this public opinion to let Martha know how much we want this to happen.
Thank you so much. With that, I'm going to call the question on this referenda question. Can we get a roll call vote for the referenda, please? Point of information.
Is there any possible vote to extend debate on this issue? I don't
feel you could dissent, and then you'd have to overrule my decision, but I will withdraw for you to speak if you'd like.
Okay. So first and foremost,
you're good. Just start speaking.
Okay. So first and foremost, I just want to say that I'm thankful that people showed up today. Our goal is to represent the student body and to represent students such as yourself with this referendum. With that being said, I do have a question. So a student beforehand, before this meeting, did reach out to me from Hillel. And his thoughts were this. He said that for him, Israel was an integral part of his identity, and that this resolution or this referendum specifically states that Israel is complicit in genocide. Whether that is true or not, I personally don't know. The ICJ has said that it's plausible, but the ICJ has also stated that Israel should make moves to limit any genocide that could be occurring, did not specifically identify Israel as a state actively promoting genocide, but rather called for it to find accountability and reduce that, and this was in January. Now, with that being said, I just wanted to pose the question both to audience members here and to the assembly as well as to whether this referendum is best for our student body going forward. fundamentally, this referendum will be a vote. This will be a yes or no decision. Yes, meaning there is a ongoing genocide promoted by the state of Israel. No, there is not. There is no room for dialogue. There is no room for unity. You are either for or against this. Now, as we've seen through the numerous protests on campus, there are many other ways that students have been vocally promoting their opinion on campus and resisting the university's current inaction. And the assembly wholeheartedly supports those. I can say that everyone here was in vocal opposition to the interim expressive action policy. We've done our utmost to limit it, and we are working with university administration right now to try and get that reversed. But again, just whether, you know, you feel free to answer this. I'm just looking to hear your thoughts. Whether such a binary decision is, in your opinion, the best option going forward.
Okay, so just to start with acknowledgement of the email you received, sure, that student might have said that Israel has been an integral part of their identity, but Palestine has been an integral part of mine. I am Palestinian, and I have had to grow up hearing the news of the occupation my entire life. Additionally, we can't deny the fact that Palestine has been ignored by the university while Israel has constantly been praised and recognized by the university. That's an undeniable fact. Palestinian students, Arab students, Muslim students, and other supporters have constantly tried to beg the university to hear their voice. We've done protests, we've made demonstrations, we've made statements. We've been here 2 times, this is our 3rd time here, but yet nothing has changed. And there's already all this tension on campus. And so we've done so much, and we're here because the resolutions didn't pass, but the referendum is a way for finally, like, the student body gets a vote. And yes, it's binary, but at the same time, I feel like after all this time, it's good that we have a final opinion that properly represents the student body to prevent, like, future tensions on campus.
Yes. Can I continue?
Yeah, you're good.
Yeah. Go additionally, I want to contest that I am Jewish. Israel has no bearing on my identity. My ancestors were from Europe, Eastern and Western. Eventually, if you go back far enough, sure, they may have been in the land that was once, that is now called the State of Israel. But they didn't speak Hebrew. They spoke Ladino. They spoke Yiddish. I have grown up in Costa Rica, and I now live in the U.S. I have never been to Israel. I don't plan on being to Israel. And beyond that, we can criticize a state. We're not criticizing the state's existence, although there are plenty of arguments that may or may not be made about the legitimacy of a state or not. What we're criticizing here, or what we want, what we are personally criticizing, and what the student body through this referendum may end up criticizing, is the actions of a state. Bringing in identity into this to say we can't criticize actions or impacts because of people's identity is just ignoring the massive impact that it is having. I've said this before, and I will continue to say it, that if some students are distraught because we decide to divest from companies that are, first of all, weapons manufacturers, which I personally believe Cornell shouldn't be engaging in the first place, but additionally, genocide, if they're distraught because of this, I would be okay with them being distraught, knowing that there are classmates that I sit to in my next to my classes every day whose families are now going to be at least a little bit safer because we're putting more pressure on the situation to end. Because we have people, like Sadin mentioned, she's Palestinian, and we have so many other people here who have family in Gaza, in Syria, in Lebanon, in the West Bank, who are suffering continuously because of everything that is happening. And I frankly place their suffering and their family suffering above the distraughtness of individuals on campus who are sad that a state is being criticized for killing over 30,000 people, injuring over 70,000 people. Regardless of that, again, this, you're bringing in the conversation that will happen when the referendum is finally done. Here we are voting on whether the students should have enough the capacity to say something about this. We have had plenty of dialogue up until this point. This has been going since October, and we have had so many conversations. We had a resolution back in October. We had one, I'm not sure if it was earlier this semester or at the end of last semester. We have had various conversations about this. It's not like there hasn't been any dialogue. It's also been so talked about in the news. But at the end of the day, we are not getting the appropriate response from the Board of Trustees. We're not getting the appropriate response from Martha Pollack herself. We have had so many emails about situations that have been happening with the Jewish community on campus, with Israel as a whole, but there has been barely any mention of Palestine. Even when finally, there was mention of a Muslim first-year student who was unfortunately spat on. There was also a person who was spat on during a pro-Palestine vigil recently, and that was not mentioned. There's been cases of harassment recently that have not been mentioned by Martha Pollock. Yes, we are forcing her hand because she refuses to listen to what the student body is telling her. We are protesting time and time again, and we will continue to do so if this referendum isn't passed. As you heard, if you don't deny this referendum by 80% of the vote or more, we can still get more signatures. In the 2 or 3 days that this petition has been out, we have gathered 950 signatures at a minimum of undergraduates, as the last time I checked. That is about 6% of the undergraduate student body. We only need 10%, and you can bet that we're going to continue getting these signatures if this referendum isn't passed in this session. So what we ask you is to recognize that democracy is important. There are so many people that want this to happen on campus. And by passing the vote, the petition for this referendum to take place, you're not making a moral judgment. You're not saying that we should do one thing or another. We welcome you that if you disagree that we should not divest or not call for a ceasefire, to still vote on this referendum and then be one of the people that votes no on this referendum.
Thank you so much. I would smell upon a motion to call the question, but I will recognize you, Representative. You haven't spoken yet.
Thank you. So I do think this is a great idea, and then we do need to force our voices to Martha. I only had one question or concern that I was thinking of is if we let the whole student body vote, I was thinking a lot of the students are not as aware as what this problem is about and like the deep details into it. And I was thinking if a lot of students who do not have a clear idea on what this is about are only given like 3 days to make a decision of a yes or no, which is adding on to David, Representative Diao's point, that if that would be a bit of a, if that would be a good representation of the whole student body.
Point of information. So to that point, after we pass the referendum, there's going to be a collection period where we can, Patrick collects pro and con arguments for both of the questions that will be presented to students, and shared with them for so that they can gain more context and be more educated and more informed when answering the referendum.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to call the question unless there's dissent. All right. I will not call the question. Representative Reziga, I'm setting a 30-second speaking time.
I just want to reiterate everything that Adrian has said. I just want to point out that, again, like as representatives of the student body, it would be really antithetical of us to just ignore the almost like 1,000 students now who have signed a petition calling for us to hold this referendum. I think it would be like wrong for us to just ignore them because of like the potential outcome of the.
Thank you. That's 30 seconds. You have 30 seconds to respond if you'd like.
Yeah, we wholeheartedly agree. We think this referendum is about putting the ideas and the numbers in front of Martha Pollock. It's up to her. At the end of the day, this referendum, if it overwhelmingly passes yes, that doesn't force the hand on the universities to commit action. It just forces Pollock to respond. And that's what we honestly need, because Pollock hasn't been responding to our demands, to our comments, to our dialogue. If you want to complain about there not being enough dialogue, ask President Pollock to have more dialogue with us, because we've been trying and trying and trying.
Thank you. Vice President Letterman.
Since I appreciate that almost 1,000 students have signed this, and while I don't necessarily agree with everything in this, I do think it's important that there's a vote. And so I just want to make sure it's neutrally worded and complies with our charter. So what I'm going to do is I move to suspend the rules, reject this referendum, and add to Resolution 66 as a survey question, the question, should Cornell University divest from weapons manufacturers to be sent to the whole undergraduate student body with the options yes, no, or unsure?
That is not in order at this time. Thank you for your dissent. Point of order. I'm literally explaining the point of order. It's not something that we vote on the resolution. And if you feel that way, then you should reject this resolution. But that's not something we have to vote on the resolution, and you can't reject the you can't all those two things together. We have to vote on the referendum, and it's not something that can be Robert rules, because it's part of our charter and is not specified in Robert rules. Thank you for your point. Vice President Parikh.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear you guys have the support to get a referendum. I support you guys in getting a referendum on the ballot. I'm just trying to find a better... I'm just trying to like help you guys achieve your goal here, right? You guys said you want a response from Martha Pollock. You want a response from administration. Would you rather have a response from them that says, oh, we reject this because something about tax status and something about, you know, we are not invested in these specific companies or some like legal jargon that they throw at you? Or would you rather force Martha to say, yeah, like this is our real position on the matter, right? If you send this referendum as it is, they can claim, oh, the referendum was not neutral, something about the tax status, whatever. They can throw a whole bunch of excuses at you guys about how this is like didn't follow the proper process or it wasn't neutrally worded. It wasn't compliant with the charter. And that'll just give them another way to get out
of order. Well, we're going to need an extension.
We go till 6:30, don't we? I have that was 20 seconds. You have 10 more seconds, Vice President Parikh.
Thank you. So all I'm asking is a referendum is going to pass today, and I'm sure this is going to be on the ballot. I'm just asking you guys to like consider making this more neutral for your own benefit. So it is more strategic and it can get a good response that helps you guys from an administrator.
You have 30 seconds to respond.
Yeah, I think that's semantics at this point. This is a referendum that's going to give us clear numbers on how many Cornell students want Cornell University to call on a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. It's going to give us numbers on how many Cornell students think that Cornell should divest from the weapons manufacturers listed. I think if we change it to be a poll or to see whether people want there to be a permanent ceasefire, in their personal opinion, is basically the same thing. Again, this doesn't really change anything, and the ultimate result will probably be the same, but we're following the procedure stated by the charter to do this as follows.
That's time. Thank you. Director Banger, you're recognized.
I think I'd just like to call us back to what this is mainly about, which is that this is a yes or no on this specific referendum. And I'd also like to generally, I guess, comment on the trend, or at least the involvement of what the role of our paternalism really should be here. We are comprised of students. Our charter is available to every student. And at the end of the day, we are faced with the force of 1,000 signatures. This really should come down to the yes or no and not off of, I guess, what was previously said by other representatives, how perfect this is, or really like what the administration has to say about this per se. They've considered this. We are, of course, are considering it too. But it's, at the end of the day, a combination of those forces as well. We have to come back to the yes or no question, regardless of what this is.
Thank you. That's time. You have 30 seconds to respond, and then I'm calling the question, and I'm not taking a cent.
Yeah, exactly. If this referendum was leading to binding decisions, perfect language would be necessary. Once again, this referendum doesn't lead to any binding decisions. All it leads to is forcing Martha Pollock to say something about this, to tell us why she will or will not lead the university to divest and to call for a ceasefire, which is ultimately the power that we have within students of the undergraduate community and you as the student assembly. That's all the power that we have at the moment. So that's what we're pursuing at this time.
Thank you. With that, I'm calling the question. Can we get a roll call vote?
Speak one more time.
No, you can't. I'm calling the question.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a roll call vote, please. Thank you. Every student assembly member must vote in a roll call vote per our charter. You have to vote yes or you have to vote no. You may not abstain. Proxies are not allowed. Point of information. Yes, we are voting to either accept the referendum as it stands or vote no to the referendum as it stands. If you vote yes and we get 50%, or more of the student assembly who votes yes, the referendum will go forward. If you vote no and we get 50% or more people voting no, the referendum can still go forward. You just have to collect 10% of the student undergraduate body signatures. If there's 80% or more voting no, the referendum dies on the floor and cannot be revived. Roll call vote, please.
Also, the speakers met with the Office of Assemblies, and so if the referendum goes forward, it'll be a Qualtrics survey. It won't be on the
ballot. That is not germane to this discussion and something that will have to be figured out by the committee that is established in the governing documents on that. It probably will be a Qualtrics survey, but none of that is set in stone. Those discussions have not been formally had. Roll call vote, please. Thank you. Rocco, point of order, information?
Point of information, a little unrelated. The Slope Day lineup is getting announced on March 23rd.
Oh, my God.
Just want to make sure everyone knows. Get very excited.
Okay, roll call vote, please.
Lucia Balastrari. Isatou Berry. Franklin Berry. Simone Chan. Rocco DiLorenzo.
No.
Zora Duram. David Diao.
Yes.
Karis Everett.
Yes.
Niles Height.
No, he said no.
Cassandra Jordan.
Yes.
Sion Kim.
No.
Clyde Letterman.
No.
Flora Meng.
Yes.
Suraj Parikh.
No.
Casey Plotkin. Amani Rizeka.
Yes.
Stella Hassan.
Oh, can proxy vote for?
We'll do proxies after. Is she on Zoom?
Yeah.
Representative Sun, you have to vote yes or no on this.
Wait, it didn't let me unmute myself earlier, and I tried to type it in chat, and it didn't let me, but no.
No.
David Soares. Adam Vincent. Amy Wang. Patrick Keel.
Yes. Now we do proxies.
For Divyaki Raju.
No.
Amita Akpan. For Yash Mudra.
No.
And for Claire Ting?
Yes.
Point of order. Two collective community votes. Would there are no more community votes in the last charter? The charter has not been updated to the current one we passed this year. Yeah, so there are no community votes. What is the final vote tally?
Like, give me one second, double check.
No, you're all good.
Fifteen yes.
10 no. This referendum will go forward, and we'll work with you to figure out how to make it go forward. Thank you. Thank you for coming. We will now move on to the next item on our agenda, legacy admissions.
I want you to take like a 5-minute recess.
Yes, we can take a 5-minute recess with the condition that we extend the meeting till 6:40. Any dissent? Okay, 5-minute recess. And we will start with legacy admissions as soon as we get back. Everybody for having us. Whoa, this is a way different place to be sitting. Resolution 68 to end legacy admissions is a combination effort between myself and three other Ivy League presidents at other student assemblies. That's Julian Satama of Yale, Mina Sarmas of Brown, and Teji Vijayakumar of Columbia. With me today, I have Evan Mandry, who just wrote a book, Poison Ivy. And as I've stated probably too many times at this point, we'll be giving a speech tonight at 7. This resolution calls on Cornell University to end the process of legacy admissions. I would urge you all to read the resolution and also look at the cited references. There's a lot of evidence to say that this is an inequitable practice and that this isn't something we should be doing to our student body and future students. Evan?
Thanks so much. I did have a moment where I thought the room was packed by people who were upset about legacy preference. Many of you may know this history. Legacy preference began in the early 20th century as a mechanism for excluding Jews from Ivy League college campuses. And today it continues as a rationalization for the over-inclusion of the wealthy. I imagine you know that Cornell is one of 38 colleges in the United States where more students come from the top 1% of the income distribution than the entire bottom 60% at Cornell. And I'm happy to share the data. I'll go through it a lot of it with you later from Raj Chetty and John Friedman at Cornell. About three times as many students come from the top 1% as the bottom 20. Some people think this isn't a big deal. It's a huge bucket. We know a lot more about this because of the SFFA lawsuit. At Harvard, 43% of students are an ALDC, either an athlete, a legacy, the child of a donor, or a staff member. Obviously, ending legacy preference would not end inequity in college admissions any more than Brown versus Board of Education ended segregation in the United States. But that doesn't mean that Brown wasn't a hugely important decision. And similarly, I think that it would be a very powerful statement for all of you to decry legacy preference. And I'm sometimes asked, I talk about this a lot. I actually had Patrick's job when I was in college, and I don't have that many regrets, but I definitely underestimated to some extent the power of the voice that you have. And even an individual statement from this assembly that legacy preference is an indefensible ethical practice, which it is, particularly in combination with other assemblies and leaders of Ivy Plus colleges, would be an incredibly powerful statement. And I'll tell you later, after my book came out, I was able to found a nonprofit called Class Action. And what we've been doing is trying to partner with students on bringing these causes. This is obviously the, I have no doubt that in 50 years, there will not be legacy preference. I just don't know whether it's going to take 5 or 45 years for it to end. And I just hope you'll accelerate the day where it ends just by a little bit. So thanks for having me. And I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any further comments to add, President Keel?
No, we'll jump to questions. Thank you.
All right. The floor is now open for questions. Representative DiLorenzo.
Thank you. So my question is, you know, I saw the book Poison Ivy. I was, you know, doing some more research on that. Is there merit to the happy bottom quarter? You know what I'm talking about? That policy from Harvard? Or yeah, so it was like back in the 60s, and like the college president was like looking to increase enrollment and seeing how like Harvard was competitive. And the president basically schemed up this way of admitting students, you know, because he was worried about their mental health and them being like happy on campus. But it doesn't matter how many students you admit into a school, right? You're always going to have a distribution. So he cited this happy bottom quarter of students that he referred to as either athletic students, and they would still be happy regardless of how they performed in school, just because of, you know, they're athletic, they could fall back on that. And then the other population was legacy students, because they could always fall back on that.
Rocco.
Yes.
Well, I'll say two things to that. One, colleges have already shown a willingness to depart from the principle of merit, if you want to call it that. So they routinely lower academic standards to admit athletes. So if they could extend themselves in that way, it's astonishing that they would, you know, that they weren't able to, or weren't willing to end that practice in the name of increased diversity, you know, in defense of race preference, affirmative action. Look, you know, you use the word happy. I always say this. I can't imagine being a socioeconomically disadvantaged student of color at a school like this, and I've spoken to hundreds, and being happy, right? I talk about how out of place I felt as sort of a vaguely middle, lower middle class white kid at Harvard. I just can't imagine how anybody could find, have any sense of community or belonging at a place like this, where, you know, it's principally the province of rich white people. And so part of this case just, you know, I think the schools would be academically better if they stopped lowering their standards to let in the children of donors and alumni, but it would obviously make it a place where there was much greater possibility for success for students of color if they were actually represented in representative numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're out of order. I'm going to call on someone else who hasn't spoken yet, and I'll recognize you for follow-up. Ms. Kim?
Hi. So thank you for bringing this resolution up. I was just thinking it in a more economic scale, should I say, because I believe the reason or what the university justifies of why they keep legacies, one, because, as Rocco said, how many people enroll in it, and also because they donate a lot of money to the university. So I was thinking, when we say we're ending legacy, would that affect the financials a lot, or is that in the consideration?
Yeah, so actually, and Evan talks about this in his book, there have been multiple studies which have shown that the ending of legacy admissions does not impact the financial security of institutions. It does not lower to any substantial manner donations that are coming into the university after universities have ended legacy admissions.
And you also have the examples of colleges like MIT, which have never practiced legacy preference and have, you know, an endowment in excess of $25 billion. And recent examples, Johns Hopkins and Wesleyan, which have entered it and shown no basis for it. And look, I just have to say, it wouldn't be a justification, right, if we said, hey, we should stop letting in students of color because we're worried that it's going to affect our fundraising, right? I mean, practices either have to be meritocratic. I'm resistant of the term meritocratic. Or fair, transparent, or they're inequitable.
Mr. Wallen.
Yeah, I always like to just preface, I am Black, obviously, and I'm a low-income student.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a low-income student, so I do not think legacy should be happening. I think that it is a racist and classist process, practice, and I feel like, if you really just think about it, if we're supposed to be getting into Cornell because of our merit, then what about the fact that, oh, your grandfather went here or he donated $1,000 or $1 billion? What does that speak to your character? How does that speak to you? And I feel like all it does is just reaffirm this system that we've had going on within this country for centuries, where people who have access, people who have resources, people who look a certain way, because there is a connection between who has money, who has resources in this country, that they get a leg up and they get something new. So I just feel like we have to end this practice, especially after it ended affirmative action. I feel like it's important to, okay, then end legacy too, because there's nothing fundamental about simply having wealth that's going to make you more valuable, more deserving of education. There's nothing about being somebody who's rich that's going to make you now, meaning that, oh, I deserve a spot more than the next person simply because there's money involved. So I hope all you guys will read the resolution thoroughly and engage in debate, but I do not think we should have legacy admission at Cornell University or anywhere, actually. But yeah.
Do you have a response or? Okay. Representative Barry.
I just wanted to unpack this idea of any person, any study a bit more. I'm in the first American University class. So we were learning a lot about the founding principles of Cornell. A lot of what it talks about is this any person, any study, it meant a university that accepted people regardless of the basis of their gender, race, class, sex, or religion. And Cornell has greatly failed with, I think, especially within metrics of class. Like we said, most of the students that go here are part of the top 1%. They come from extremely wealthy families. And I think it shows the organization that exists on campus, Basic Needs Coalition, people that come to lower income students that come to the school are uncomfortable. And there is a need to I think represent them more. And I think once they're more representative of the student body, it'll make the overall Cornell experience a lot better. And And I think it'll just be a more equitable process.
Mr. Mandry?
Obviously, I agree with that. I'll just say that, I'm pretty net pessimistic about where we are as a country and as a planet. one of the things that's gone wrong in the United States is mistrust of the elites. But if you haven't gone to college and you don't know anybody who's ever going to go to a school like this, why should you have any trust in them? And I always tell this story, like, you know, I don't mistrust journalism, even though I have problems with articles I read, because I actually know three people who are on the masthead of the New York Times. But if you grow up in rural Appalachia or wherever, and you have no, you've never met anybody who has a job like that, you have no chance that your kid's ever going to have a pathway to a job like that. Why should you have any trust? So this isn't just about diversification of access to this type of degree. It's about diversification of access to the elite in the United States.
Thank you. Representative Height. I know you've spoken a lot, and I know Niles hasn't spoken yet during this meeting, so I wanted to balance it out. I will call on you after I call on Representative Height. I'm just trying to make sure that the meeting is run in a balanced way. I will call on you next, I promise. Representative Height.
She can speak wherever she wants to, like it's not it.
Okay. Representative, Representative Everett.
No, and thank you, Niles, for your time. And I would expect that your turn will come next. I just wanted to say that I think the importance of this resolution cannot be overstated. You know, I'm a contextualist at heart, and I think that, you know, we can acknowledge that this country has systemic barriers that prohibit marginalized communities from accessing institutions such as these. I mean, to this day, and I'm from California, probably one of the bluest states you can get, Santa Monica Beach, and my father has a friend whose deed to his home says shall not be sold to a Negro, and that's in the deed to his home in 2024. You know, I think that it's very important that this assembly, and I would honestly love to hear if there's anyone that's against this resolution. It seems like everyone's pretty much in agreement. I mean, I think we need to set a precedent that shows that this assembly, this institution stands with the progress of creating accessibility to exceptional places, because we are a country of exceptional people that just haven't been given the historical chance. And I think it's time that we begin that now.
Mr. Mandry, Representative Height.
So I want to start. So like, as someone who is legacy here at Cornell, legacy is dumb, and like my whole thing with it is I just like the whole notion that like someone in my family went here, so like I'm like more likely to get in here just because of that. And like I get the whole like, oh, they're more likely to donate though. However, I feel like it does leave out a huge demographic of people, especially like when you're looking at like statewide demographics as well. Like a bunch of people here, like I'm from Illinois, and like everyone here is from like the East Coast or just like New York in general, or just like computer schools in general. And I think like that often leaves out the people who don't have like the resources or opportunities to get to those places. And like it ultimately, like it doesn't help either, because like I'm like, no shade to like some of the legacy kids I've met, but like no one's like any smarter, no one's like any better or anything. And to be honest, like with the whole application process, I don't think it should be a factor. I don't think so, because if that's like something that you need to get in here, I mean, it probably should not be here, in my opinion. But
I just want to briefly say it's very important that this is not a personal argument, right? This is not an argument that somebody who's here doesn't belong here. This is an institutional argument. And, you know, I was here through your earlier discussion. I think a lot about what it means to have 501c3 status. So elite colleges get about $20 billion a year in tax subsidies, right? Harvard, Cornell, Yale, if you donate, it's tax deductible. Their earnings on your contribution are tax deductible. They don't pay state tax. They don't pay property tax. They often don't pay local taxes. And they're lousy local citizens for the most part, too. So what does doing good mean? Well, there's only two things I can imagine, which is you take a bunch of rich kids and you turn them into do-gooders. Well, about 65% of Harvard students go on to careers in investment banking, management consultant in the tech sector. And there's a little tiny sliver of the pie graph, which is the people that go into public service. Or you let in a diverse cross-section of society. And obviously, look, this is Cornell, right? Not everybody's going to get in. What we're talking about are no arbitrary barriers to access.
Yeah, I'd also just like to point out, I noticed a little bit at the start of your argument, you said you understood the argument with donations. I just want to re-emphasize the point but there's no substantial evidence that that is true. And we've seen that from our peer institutions like MIT.
Oh, yes. What time is it? All right. I would entertain a motion to extend the meeting to 6:45.
Motion to extend the meeting to 6:45.
Representative Vincent, is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Is there any objection? That objection so ordered. The next speaker is Representative Rzeka.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak a little on my experience. So I'm African American, my mom grew up in the projects of Brooklyn, and she didn't even graduate high school. She dropped out, and eventually she did get her GED. But there are a lot of like systemic barriers in place that makes like the experiences of my mom like very commonplace within my community. And it's kind of an anomaly that I could be at an institution like this, given the like great systems of like oppression that are like so deeply intertwined into like the founding of this nation, that I could even be at like this type of high level institution. And like, I think that knowing how much it takes for students of color, students from marginalized backgrounds, students who are low income to be able to make it to this university, and to know that like there are other students who are given preferential admissions just because their parents went here. And the fact that their parents went here probably indicates that their parents made a lot of money, and they probably didn't have to face as many economic barriers in terms of getting the resources that they needed in order to strengthen their admissions applications to get here in the first place. Like, I had to work to get that on my own. And I think that speaks to the experience of a lot of marginalized students at this school.
Mr. Mandring.
Well, I'm very glad you're here. I teach at a college where 2/3 of our students come from families making less than $30,000. And I've taught one rich white student in my 25-year career. I would say the sentiment that animated my writing this book and the work that I do in this area is a career spent teaching talented, socioeconomically disadvantaged students of color who are super smart. And I know from my experience when I was in law school, I was a teaching fellow who could do the work at a place like this. And the main thing I want to do is combat the myth that they're not here because they couldn't handle the work.
Director Thomas.
Thanks. I just wanted to say very quickly, I appreciate you coming here. I think it's a very important thing to talk about. There are many inequalities within the admission system that I think need to be addressed. I just wanted to bring up very quickly, Cornell University is very unique in this situation amongst the Ivy League, amongst other schools, because we are a land grant. I just wanted to push back at the argument real quick, because I do think it's a very harmful argument that Legacy admits are dumb, or that they don't deserve to be here, or anything like that. Many of our Legacy admissions in this specific school come from dairy backgrounds, from farming backgrounds in rural areas, and given the stereotypes that exist, I just think that that's a very harmful notation. I appreciate you calling that out.
I didn't say that. No, I didn't hear anybody.
I'm saying
that,
I appreciate actually. You responding to that, saying that Legacy admissions are not dumber, is not partial.
There are lots and lots of smart people in the world.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond because that was mentioned earlier. Thanks.
I will now, yes, that is an order, but I will now recognize Representative Barry.
I'll say I have not read your book. I think I've heard of your book. And I've definitely thought a little about the legacy admission issue. I don't think I've come to a like full terms on how I feel exactly about it, because I feel like legacy admissions, obviously, like historically, definitely just used as an oppression tool and a tool to like consolidate and hoard wealth and knowledge. But on the back end of that, of what you would hope legacy admissions would become, 100 years from now, would really more just be like a school pride thing. Because of course, if a student is so smart that they could make it into such an institution, they of course could make it into many other elite institutions. And then it just becomes more of a matter of, well, I want to go here because my mom did. And then there's those those fence issues of like, you know, you got two students who are like almost exactly the same and you're like, ugh, which one should I pick? And it's like, I don't necessarily 100% disagree that a student who's had a past person come to the institution, that doesn't give them a slight advantage in those very unique situations. But my greater issue or like question would be, we've expressed that because I'm not concerned about losing money because of not having legacy commission emissions. If anything, I'm concerned because of it in the statement that, you know, if we get rid of legacy emissions, of course, we're not getting rid of those rich parents that donate a bunch of money to the school. So I'm unfamiliar with the admission process. And if, you know, they just see legacy, like fourth time legacy, they just assume that the parents must have donated a bunch of money over the years or something. And that's how it works. Or if, and we all have in the back of our minds that admissions kind of know whose parents donated what at certain times. And I have experience with other low income families who have these, you know, exceptional parents who have made it into a great institution, but of course they didn't go on to make a lot of money. So their legacy is like only like so effective because they weren't able to donate to the college. So could you speak to how this like somehow?
Well, you said a lot of things and you're thinking through the issue. I just want you to own one thing as you think through this. Meritocracy is a double-edged sword. Desert is a double-edged sword. If you say that people deserve a slight advantage in the admissions process by virtue of mommy or daddy having gone to this college, then you say someone deserves their disadvantage in the admissions process because mommy or daddy did not go to this college. So you have to own that statement. And I'll just say a second thing. Brown just issued a, from my standpoint, astonishingly stupid statement, sort of postponing any decision on legacy preference. Look, I heard a lot of different things in what you were saying. One trend I heard there is, you know, maybe things are a little bit better, right? And you understand this history of racism and sexism at these schools. It's not ancient history. It's yesterday, right? If you want to, you have to look. So maybe if you had equitable practices in a diverse class, maybe I still wouldn't like legacy preference, but I wouldn't see it as a systematic disadvantage to poor students of color. But what percentage of Cornell alumni in their totality do you think are Black? Right. So right now you're up to about a 13%. You're up to about 13%. You're not even still at a representative sample of America. When I went to college, if you look at my, I'm embarrassed to have you look at my class Facebook page. It's maximally 3% Black students. Right. So the blended average over the 20th century of these institutions, it's a minuscule percentage. So I'm a teacher. I'm all for people thinking things through. I just have to say, I've never heard a cogent ethical defense of legacy preference. I've never even heard an admissions officer or a college president defend it. They just say, we're just going to keep doing it. It's just a raw assertion of power.
President Keel. Vice President Parikh.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say I'm also fully in support of this. I think that legacy admissions is, again, like an arbitrary thing. It is definitely like class discrimination. It's part of what I see as part of a broader like class war on working class people in this country. And it's just a way for the ultra wealthy, the elite in America to continue propagating their own position there. I think a big problem is that like in the United States, so many of our political institutions are dominated by people who went to Harvard, who went to Yale, went to these elite colleges. And with legacy, you get that people in that family continue to go to these colleges, and you really don't have a diversity of viewpoints from Americans from different backgrounds. And it's kind of one of the reasons why you have politics so like stagnant and regressive as it is. So I'm fully in support of the resolution. I think it seems like that is also the general consensus here. So I'm wondering if we should call the question. I would motion to vote on this resolution.
There is a motion to call the question. Is there a second? There being a sufficient second, the question is now on ending debate. Those in favor? Those opposed? The question is now on adoption of resolution. The question is now on the adoption of resolution 68 to end legacy admissions. Those in favor? Count on this. And those opposed? The resolution is agreed to.
You wanna bring us home real quick? Finish out that last resolution with a vote of unanimous consent.
Is there any objection to the approval of resolution number 66, the finalization of survey question language? Seeing no objection, the resolution is agreed to. Is there any objection to the adjourning the meeting?
No.
Without objection, so ordered.